Welcome to Tokyo Game Life, a Tokyo-based video game podcast focusing on Nintendo and gaming culture in Japan's capital. Your host, Mono, here. In Tokyo, it's getting dark at about 4 p.m., so you've really got just two options. Go out and see Christmas lights, or stay inside and play video games. Or be like me and do both. I love this time of year for gaming because all the holiday games have come out, so you can really spend some quality time with them, or just tackle your backlog. It's a nice break from the week after week of major game releases. It's hard to believe the year is almost over. 2021 was an interesting one in the gaming world, to say the least. It was pretty rough at times, with stock shortages and delays for a lot of major titles, but luckily there were so many great games that came out this year. This year in particular had a lot of games that really snuck up on me, or completely blew away my expectations. Some of my favorite games this year weren't even announced until a few months ago. I suppose that's pretty typical if you're a Nintendo fan, since the announcement to release gap is shortening with every year, it seems. The past episode of Tokyo Game Life had me highlighting games I was playing, but this episode is going to be dedicated to my personal Game of the Year awards. I suppose I need to have some sort of clever name for the award, but hey, they weren't called the Oscars year one. Let's just shove everything under the Game of the Year umbrella. There's space under there, I think. Here's how today's episode will go. I'll start off by listing my top 5 favorite games of 2021, including my pick for Game of the Year. I think this is a great way to gauge your interest in this show, as you would think, those picks are crazy, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about, or you'll think, yes, finally, somebody with some taste. I will say you probably won't find anyone out there with this top 5. I'll also be dishing out awards to other random things like Best 2020 Game I Played in 2021, Best Retro Game, Best Remake, Remaster, Port, Best Game Called A Short Hike, and so on. After I give the gift of gold to those games, I'll go over the news. I'm always worried there won't be enough to talk about this time of year, but it keeps trickling in. This episode's feature will be about Super Potato, a famous chain of retro game stores in Japan. Oh, and a bit of house cleaning. I've added transcripts for all my episodes to my website, tokyogamelife.com. Just click on the episodes page and you'll have not only the supplemental material, but also a record of every little word I say. Yes, even this one. All right, let's get started. Video games. Some are good, some are bad. Fewer are truly great. And those are the games I want to highlight in the Tokyo Game Life Game of the Year Awards. It's okay to have game twice in the title, right? This first section is going to focus on my top 5 games of the year. I love all these games, but I only have so much love to give, so I have to proportion out my love via rankings. Okay, my number 5 game of 2021 is Metroid Dread. This is Mercury Steam's second go at the series that always seems to be in some sort of perpetual state of limbo. I would consider myself a Metroid fan, but it's not one of my favorite Nintendo franchises. I am more of a 2D Metroid fan than a 3D one. So I was pretty excited to see a 2D title get announced at E3. And that Dread name? Perfect. That was Nintendo screaming, "We hear you, hardcore fans." I feel like this is exactly what fans of Super Metroid, Zero Mission, and Metroid Fusion have been clamoring for. It is a straightforward Metroid title where you explore an isolating alien landscape, gradually unlock more of the map as you gain new abilities and powers, and pull out all of your tricks to find secrets. There's no catch, there's no real major gameplay gimmick in how you play it. This is the Metroid title that fans have wanted for years. It borrows liberally from the past, while also implementing some really fun ideas like the Emmys. I thought the Emmys would be more controversial at first, but they were so well implemented in terms of pacing. They aren't bothering you every 2 seconds, but when you do enter an Emmy zone, there is an intensity to navigating these areas. They are a great way to diversify the gameplay. Each Emmy zone almost feels like a puzzle. You have to discover an optimal route and then execute your escape. For something that was so heavily advertised, they really weren't a major part of the game, but I think they work perfectly as an element to break up the typical exploration and combat sections. I saw on Twitter a comparison of all the Metroid maps, and Dread's map is significantly larger. However, it doesn't feel that way since movement is so quick and smooth. Remember in past Metroid games where you would get knocked off a platform by a bug and then fall for like a mile and a half, and it takes you 30 seconds to get back up? That never happens here because you have so many traversal tools. I'm a big fan of the phase shift and how you warp around. It's incredibly useful during boss fights, too. This does tie into one of my main criticisms of the game, however. It's very safe in a lot of aspects. Many of the items are things you've seen before, like the power bomb, and the collectibles are just missiles and health upgrades. I have a million-dollar idea, though. Collectible plushies. Instead of missile tank number 35, why not have it be a Metroid plushie? You could look at it, spin it around in a 3D model viewer. Don't tell me this wouldn't have improved the game. The game isn't a looker, but it has a clean art style. I think they prioritized frame rate and developed an art style that could work without compromising the game's speed and fluency. The animation is pretty excellent too. I love how Samus pushes her hand up against the walls, and the counter, especially the running counter, always looks stylish. Dread is fairly story light, but when they do decide to move the plot along, the cutscenes are incredibly memorable. I love Samus' personality in this game. She seems so experienced, so confident, but it doesn't become some sort of tough guy or tough girl parody. For people who are deeply invested in the Metroid lore, this game is like Christmas. Sakamoto has said it is the end of Samus' adventure with the titular Metroids, but it clearly leaves many things open for Samus to blow up a few more planets down the line. This was also the first Metroid game I 100%ed, largely in part to how easy it is to move around. Oh, the missile tank I need is on the other side of the planet? No problem. There are plenty of warp points and shortcuts I can use to get me there. One thing that typically turns me off from Metroid games is that they are quite short. Only about 7 or 8 hours to beat, and if you're paying $50 or $60, that's not exactly a lot of meat on the bone. But I really do recommend trying to 100% it. I got over 15 hours, maybe even closer to 20 on my Switch system clock, because it took me that much time to explore every little section. If you're a Metroid fan, I can't imagine how you could possibly be disappointed with this game. From the story to the moment-to-moment gameplay, it completely nails everything that's interesting about the franchise. Is it better than Super? Maybe. That's a hard thing to say. I do love Super Metroid's world and pacing, but that could just be nostalgia. No matter what, Metroid Dread is a standout title from this year. This is number one on a lot of people's lists, and I can understand why. Now, what game could possibly top Metroid Dread? I've got two words for you. Dungeon Encounters. If that didn't make you want to turn off the podcast, please stick with me. If you listened to the last episode, you know that I raved about this quirky budget title from Square Enix. It's a straightforward dungeon crawler, where you navigate floors filled with traps and monsters as you slowly descend further and further into the heart of the dungeon. It contrasts a minimalistic story and overworld with vibrant character art and a rockin' soundtrack. Literally, it's blaring rock music, which I can't help but love. Now, I like dungeons in games. Zelda, JRPGs in general. Dungeons are a vital part of the adventure experience. But I am not really into dungeon crawlers per se. I think these areas work better as specific moments in an overall game, and not the entire theme. I like the dread of entering a new dungeon, conquering it, and then the cathartic feeling of leaving stronger and having some much-needed downtime. Dungeon Encounters focuses mostly on the dungeon part, but it does capture those other key elements of JRPGs. You feel a sense of accomplishment when you conquer each floor and grow exponentially stronger. And anytime you return to your home base, it feels like a nice warm bath. Dungeon Encounters completely nails the ebb and flow of exploring a treacherous landscape. It piques your curiosity with hidden areas, items just out of view, and unknown enemy encounters. There are times where you have to make hard decisions, whether to press on or whether to pull back. The fact that there are so many wild obstacles thrown your way, like snakes that can eat your entire party, or Medusa turning someone into stone, or tiles that will take away your money, all these things really make every battle feel like it could be your last. I think the minimalism greatly contributes to the game, as it helps keep the player focused and makes the pacing quite speedy overall. There's no wasted time here wondering if you can interact with something or drawn out cutscenes that force you to stop. You are solely focused on getting stronger, descending down into the dungeon, and everything else impairing that goal isn't needed. It's stripped down in a lot of ways, but not in terms of gameplay. The battle system is excellent, as it's both strategic yet very susceptible to cheesing, which is a good thing. Battles are not mindless at all. You are not just picking attack and watching health bars instantly go down. Since stats and attacks are completely determined by gear, you really get a lot of freedom in terms of customizing your party and giving them specific roles. You could have someone focus only on magic attacks, someone only on physical attacks, someone who can hit all enemies but with random damage, someone who can instantly kill an enemy 50% of the time, there were so many times when I stumbled upon an item and thought, this changes everything. It's so satisfying to struggle against a certain enemy and then to just destroy them in one hit after finding a few key items. I think a lot of developers struggle in figuring out what makes a good turn-based battle system. So many are against it in the first place, since they want more action-oriented combat, and a lot of RPGs these days have shifted over to being more action RPGs instead of party-focused turn-based battles. And this is a shame, because titles like Dungeon Encounters or Bravely Default show that you can still have a lot of fun with thought-provoking turn-based battles that go beyond picking the same attack over and over again. One of the main reasons why this game connected with me is the tremendous amount of party customization and how wildly powerful you can get almost instantly. You might find an item that does 10,000 damage when all your characters are equipped with swords that do 300 damage. You will stumble across another party member who is 10 levels ahead of everyone on your team and is equipped with armor you've never seen before. If you solve a math riddle or a map puzzle, you'll be rewarded with something absurd like a weapon that can instantly destroy the magic defense of all enemies. Combat slowly morphs from min-maxing your attacks just to survive an encounter to figuring out the most efficient way to completely obliterate the enemy side in just two or three turns. There are so many times where I thought I broke the game, but yes, it does creep back up on you and it has its own unexpected obstacles to throw your way. So the game never feels like a cakewalk, despite being able to kill enemies in one hit. Moving around the overworld, which is just an interlocking grid of squares, is more fun than I thought it would be. You want to find every square on each floor so you can get some bonus equipment points, and because, well, of course it's fun to see numbers go up. Each level has its own unique theme and layout. Turns out you can really do a lot design-wise with just lines and lines of squares. Dungeon Encounters has to be my biggest surprise of the year. It was casually announced at TGS, looked almost comically low-budget, but when the gameplay foundations are solid, and the game uses its limitations to its advantage, you can end up with something truly special. Sticking in RPG land, my third favorite game this year is Monster Hunter Stories 2: Wings of Ruin from Capcom and Marvelous. A bit of a spoiler, Monster Hunter Rise is not on this list, so this might be the only list ever that puts Stories 2 ahead of Rise. But once you hear me out, I think you'll understand why. I'm not really a Monster Hunter fan at all. I tried 3 and 4 and fell off pretty quickly. I did manage to beat the story of World, but even though I enjoyed that game, I felt like I got what I wanted out of the franchise. I skipped Rise since it really just looked like another Monster Hunter game, and no matter what cool things they might add to the series, I'm not really interested in getting back in. However, I was really engaged by Monster Hunter Stories 2. The game is framed as a monster collecting RPG, so yes, think Pokemon. However, like other good monster hunting RPGs, it doesn't simply copy the formula Pokemon mastered. Monster Hunter Stories 2 separates itself by taking everything that's fun and exciting about the franchise and perfectly translating it into a JRPG. They streamline so many aspects, yet it's still faithful to the source material. The best part about Monster Hunter? Obviously the monster fights. I mean, that's what everything revolves around, right? Fights in Monster Hunter are fun because every encounter is like a boss fight. It requires strategy and reflexes, and each battle is dynamic in how you approach it and what the enemy can throw at you. There's a rhythm to it that you need to master. Yet for me, these are long, often laborious battles where you could be annihilated at any moment. I enjoy these fights, especially with others, but they take a while, and I never feel like I'm doing a lot of damage or contributing in a significant way. Monster Hunter Stories 2 says, what if instead of 30 minutes, it takes 3 minutes, and yet you can still do all the fun things you would do in a normal Monster Hunter battle? You target weak points, you knock monsters down and wail on them, you unleash special attacks, you can use traps and other items, and so on. If you're a hardcore Monster Hunter fan, you will be amazed at how accurately it's translated into an RPG battle. And even if you've never played Monster Hunter, you will be impressed at how rich the battle system really is. I've seen some people say it's rock, paper, scissors, but that is fairly reductive. It's not simply about picking the blue attack when they have a red attack, although that helps. That aspect is similar to the press turn system in Shin Megami Tensei, but it alone isn't going to win you battles. You need to think about special moves, exploiting elemental weaknesses, and timing your super attack. Stories 2 focuses less on mindless mob battles and has fewer encounters than most JRPGs, which is incredibly refreshing. You have a team of monsters, but you can only use one at a time. However, your player character also fights next to the monster, so you have two active party members you control. Syncing your abilities with each other is vital to winning battles. Most of the time, you also have an AI party member that changes each chapter. All these new party members are completely unique in their look and how they battle. I don't want to get into heavy spoilers, but you are a monster rider, so of course you fight with your monster. and you also team up with other monster riders. So most battles have two monsters and two characters. However, in one chapter, you team up with a monster hunter, so instead of the rider-monster combo, you just have a really strong guy helping you. This really helps keep battle fresh the entire game, as your support has their own strengths that you can take advantage of. Each battle seems like it matters, since they can be quite difficult if you aren't paying attention. Plus, the drops you get are actually useful and critical to helping you get stronger. Yes, like in the main game, monsters drop parts that you can use to make armor and weapons. Instead of individual armor pieces like shoes and gloves and helmets, you just equip one piece of armor, which is awesome and reduces grinding just to get mats. Weapons also work the same way. There's no upgrade tree that you need to follow. Do you have 5 Diablo's horns? You can make a big sword. The game has a solid upgrade flow where you upgrade your weapon and armors at a steady pace while also having a lot of customization options. You can craft gear that gives you specific resistances, or maybe you want to focus on dealing out damage with a specific elemental attack. It really scratches that customization itch, and I always have that itch. The monsters themselves also have a lot of customization options. They have what I would describe as an ability grid, and you can attach abilities to each monster. If there's a synergy, like for example you attach all fire attacks, it will give buffs and unlock even more sockets to put abilities in. You can mix and match abilities to make really unexpected loadouts. Sure, you can give Nurigigante a water attack, why not? The game also has a wonderful cel-shaded art style, with vibrant colors and rich details on the characters and monsters. It looks excellent, but yes, there is slowdown every now and then, especially in the second 4C village. If you can look past that, I think you'll be impressed. All the gear and weapons looks cool too, though sometimes they can look a bit goofy. You can customize your gear's color though, which is really great. While the battles are the game's strongest point, it also excels at exploration. Each chapter unlocks a new area to explore. Each area is basically a town that serves as your home base, and also a big expansive field filled with monsters, caves, and other nooks and crannies to explore. Here you will also find monster dens, which serve as mini dungeons where you navigate a small map section until you find an egg that you can take, which will then hatch into a monster that you can use in battle, or you can just take the abilities from the egg and give it to other monsters. The game definitely has a loop to it. Each area has some new element to mix things up, but you are fighting monsters, delving into dens to get eggs, leveling up gear, repeat. There's no goofy minigames, and side quests are pretty much just find X item or defeat X monster. So if the loop doesn't hook you, you might find the game repetitive. However, to me, the core gameplay mechanics were so strong. The battles were great and engaging, and I honestly felt sad when it ended, even though it does have quite a bit of post-game content. If you love monster collecting RPGs, I highly recommend this game. I was amazed at how much fun I was having with it. I'm now excited for our new Monster Hunter games, solely because that means they will make more monsters to put into future Monster Hunter Stories games. Also, I am pretty sure that Pokemon Legends Arceus will have a very similar structure to this game in how you explore the world, but we'll see. We're at number 2 now. So far, they've all been Switch games, and technically this one is too, but I didn't play it on Switch. My second favorite game of 2021 is Hitman 3 from IO Interactive. Yes, this game came out in 2021. January is still part of the year. This is the conclusion to the Hitman soft reboot that started with Hitman 2016 and is an incredible finale to one of the best gaming trilogies. This series stands out in that it's truly unique. I can't think of another series that duplicates what makes Hitman excellent. I saw a lot of people compare Deathloop to Hitman this year, but that is such a surface level comparison. Deathloop is fine, but it's no Hitman. If you've never played the series, you are an assassin thrown into a massive and intricate level where you have to assassinate your target or targets. Part stealth, part action, part puzzle, this series rewards critical thinking and observational skills over quick reflexes. Most of the levels have you hiding in plain sight, and it's up to you to slowly figure out what secrets and opportunities hide in each place. The best assassinations are based around completing side quest-esque objectives that put you in an opportunity to eliminate your target in some fantastical fashion. But you don't have to do these objectives at all. You have infinite freedom in how you approach the game. Hitman 3 tells you the objective and sets you free. You do it however you want. The levels in Hitman are perhaps some of the best in gaming. Each section has a purpose, and there is no way that you will discover every little area on your first or even second playthrough. I'm constantly blown away by these huge sections of the map I suddenly discover that had nothing to do with how I achieved the objective the first go around. And since the game revolves heavily around costume changes, which let you hide in plain sight, it's fun to just casually walk around and explore. I like to watch the NPCs chatter with each other or go on with their routine. I often hear the phrase lived in world to describe the authenticity of a level, especially in open world games, but very few come close to portraying a space as well as Hitman does. And yes, these levels are designed to be played over and over again. The first game was an episodic release, where one map was released every other month or so. A lot of people hated this idea, since the franchise has never done it before, and episodic releases, well, you don't really see them around as much anymore, do you? It feels like the company is trying to sell you an incomplete game. But it totally worked in Hitman 2016. It gave players time to explore each level thoroughly, to share strategies online, to discover secrets you didn't see even after 4 playthroughs. It was a difficult thing to market, but it made sense once you played it. Hitman 2 and now 3 have all the levels available from the start, which is great, but I do feel most players just play the level once and then move on. Yeah, you can do this, but don't forget to go back. Hitman 3 is interesting in that it feels very much aimed at fans of the first 2 games. You can still jump into this title without playing the others, but it takes a lot of conventions from the first 2 games and subverts them in very interesting ways. The first level, Dubai, is your pretty standard new Hitman level. You're at a high-class party, mingling with the rich and powerful, in an incredibly detailed skyscraper. The next level has you explore an English manor, and it's all themed around a murder mystery. You can take the detective's disguise and then solve the murder. And there's not just one way to do it either. IO Interactive basically built a whole gameplay mechanic just for this one level. The next stage, Berlin, completely throws away the concept of knowing who and where your target is once you enter the level, and has you hunt down your targets by eavesdropping. There are 10 possible targets, and you have to take out about half to finish the level. All the levels in Hitman 3 feel so different from the other games, yet still capture the sense of scale and freedom. A lot of the changes from the other 2 games are fairly incremental, like upgrades in UI, and one of the big additions here is that you could unlock shortcuts that will be open the next time you play the level. Kind of like Dark Souls, this franchise doesn't reinvent the wheel each time. It simply gives you more of what you love, and that works because no other franchise is doing what Hitman does. Another incredible thing about this game is that you can play the levels from Hitman 1 and 2 and Hitman 3 if you own the previous games or buy the DLC. Having all these levels and campaigns in one game is honestly incredible. I am talking hundreds and hundreds of hours of gameplay. I've never seen a game do this before. The closest thing I can think of is Pokemon and how you can trade up your Pokemon from the past generations. Yes, this might be the only podcast that directly connects Hitman and Pokemon. This is why you're listening, for these deep insights. The fact that we even got Hitman 3 is a miracle. The new trilogy has had 3 different publishers, and maybe it didn't reach the audience a lot of expected, but once you play it, you will understand it's an amazingly unique gameplay experience. On Switch, you can play the cloud version if you're into that. If you have a PS5 and you're thinking, I don't know what to play, the answer is Hitman 3. As for the best level, in Hitman 3, I love the Berlin level. Stalking your targets is so fun, and the level is filled with a lot of optional areas. For the series overall, I'm not trying to be biased here, but the Hokkaido level is my favorite. It takes place in an onsen resort that also has a high-tech hospital. The contrast between the very traditional look of the resort and the futuristic hospital is very striking. And there's a lot of fun things you can do, like use fugu poison or throw shurikens. Hitman 3, play it! Here it is. Number 1. The official Tokyo Game Life Game of the Year. It's an unconventional one for sure. I doubt many will have it at the top. Even I wouldn't have believed you if you said it would be my favorite game of 2021 when it was announced. My game of the year is New Pokemon Snap, developed by Bandai Namco. Harada himself sat down and coded this masterpiece. Okay, maybe not, but let's give a shout out to Bandai Namco for this game and, of course, Smash. A lot of people probably assume this is a nostalgia pick, but not so. Obviously, I'm a huge Pokemon fan. The spin-offs are really hit and miss. I did own Pokemon Snap back in the day, and I enjoyed it, but even as a kid I knew it was flawed. It was very short, kind of repetitive, and was propped up by the novel idea and the appeal of seeing Pokemon in 3D. These things used to be a centimeter high in black and white, and now they are full-blown 3D on my 13-inch CRT. It was mind-blowing. But yes, Pokemon Snap for the N64 is a fun oddity, but a tough sell at $50 or $60. I wanted a sequel for a long time because taking photos is so ingrained in our daily lives. And with advances in camera technology, I always thought Snap had a ton of potential. Even so, I was skeptical that a lot of issues with the first game would still be present, namely the short length and the lack of variety. Fortunately, New Pokemon Snap fixes the issues with the first game while also greatly expanding upon the game's concept. I feel every gameplay decision Nintendo and Bandai Namco made with the game is absolute genius. They looked at the structure of the original and thought, how can we make fresh, worthwhile content without it feeling bloated and repetitive? There are a few key gameplay decisions that heavily contribute to its greatness. Having one stage with multiple levels that add new elements as you level up helps you learn the stage while also introducing exciting new things. At level 1, you are just learning the layout and discovering the little stories that play out. You're not going to find everything in one go. You're going to notice something you didn't get a picture of and want to jump back in. After 2 or 3 tries, you level up, which adds new things to the stage and refreshes the world before it feels tiresome. And at level 3, the game expects you to have mastered the layout and the stories happening in the world. So you have free rein to focus on whatever you want and go into every little nook and cranny to find secret scenarios and hidden Pokemon. I always felt excited when I leveled up because each new stage refresh feels significant since it adds a lot of new Pokemon and routes. These levels are jam-packed with Pokemon and fun scenarios. New Pokemon Snap is essentially a puzzle game where you have to discover how to interact with Pokemon in order to find a specific shot. Some are simple, some are quite complex and requires multiple steps to pull off. Discovering these interactions and then pulling off the perfect shot is an amazing sensation. The game does another smart thing in that it remixes levels with day and night versions. Even though the layout may be similar, the Pokemon can be completely different. It really does feel like a brand new level, which gives the game an incredible amount of variety, even though they are using the same parts. It is so smart in how they revamp these levels. I also think that the stages are consistently excellent and only get better as the game progresses. The first 2 stages are honestly the weaker ones, and the jungle one can be difficult to master, so I think a lot of people fall off here. But after that, the world really opens up. You have multiple stages you can tackle, and then completing those unlock other stages along with their day and night cycle and so on. I thought many times, okay, they've used all their tricks and the game is going to end soon. But no, the game has so many ideas. There's a creepy foggy forest where you can find secret routes that lead to areas with different seasons. There's an underwater level where you can stay in the reefs or dive even deeper into sunken ruins. There are even boss fights where you are pitted against a single Pokemon and you have to try to get the best shot possible. There's also a mini course where you can go around the research lab. This really seems like they're flexing on us. They absolutely did not need to give us this extra small level, but they did, and it's completely different from the other stages. You can even go inside the lab. A few courses are optional too, so those who want to rush to the end are free to do so. When I was daydreaming about a Pokemon Snap sequel, I wanted it to be one where you could actually walk around and take photos. I was a bit disappointed when they showed off that it would be on rails again, but the game is completely built around this concept, and the structure complements the fact that you are constantly moving. You kind of have to miss things every now and then, so you are encouraged to jump back in. But I never felt it was unfair, as every time I went into a level, I discovered something new and got a new photo ranking. Not only are the levels brilliantly designed, but the concept of ranking Pokemon based on the rarity of their actions is so smart. This is actually a bit controversial with some people because they want to take an artsy photo and are disappointed when they're hit with a low score. But it's hard to give a score to art, so having more specific requirements suits the game. However, you can still take those artsy photos. No one is stopping you. The player is free to save any photo they take to their catalog, and they could even make it their primary one in their Pokédex if they want. The game caters to those who want a challenge and want to complete objectives, and those who just want to take silly pictures. New Pokémon Snap also has excellent photo editing features and even lets you reframe and reshoot your shots to a degree. I'm always impressed by the highlighted photos I see online. Back to the ranking system. In the old game, you basically took a photo of a Pokemon and then tried to raise that single score. Now, each Pokemon has 4 different rankings, so there are 4 different scores per Pokemon. Multiply a few hundred Pokemon times 4, and yeah, that's a lot of photo opportunities. If you want the rarest ranking, you need to solve intricate puzzles or nail the timing. This ranking system works perfectly with the structure of the stages, especially how they remix the day and night cycle. And it's not like the 4-star photos are the only good ones. I have a lot of photos I love that are only 1 or 2 star rankings. The game wonderfully portrays Pokemon in their natural habitat and all the silly and scary things that come with that. This is something the main games don't really capture as well. Of course, the Pokemon are just hidden in the grass, or now they kind of aimlessly wander around the field, but they don't feel integrated into nature. This game is all about Pokemon in their world and how they live their daily lives. And by giving the player so many levels to explore, remixing those levels, and giving multiple objectives per Pokemon, there really is an incredible amount of content here if you are hooked by the gameplay. This is not something you will just finish in 1 or 2 sittings. I've put in 40 hours and there's still so much I haven't done. Speaking of content, Nintendo released a free update a few months ago with new stages and Pokemon. Absurd, I would have easily paid for this, but they just handed it out for free. It's like taking a big scoop of ice cream and putting it on top of an entire chocolate cake. This game is just a joy to play, and I was constantly impressed by how every decision made with the gameplay structure worked perfectly together. The game strikes a wonderful tone between being relaxing and casual and also very intense and exciting when you were trying to get a specific photo. It's hard to pick my favorite photo, though. I like the Pinsir and Heracross fight, or the Pidgeot scooping up the Magikarp, and the Wishiwashi boss fight is also spectacular. So, new Pokemon Snap, game of the year. I highly recommend it to anyone, even if you're not a big Pokemon fan. There is so much here to enjoy and discover. So my top 5 games of 2021, number 1, new Pokemon Snap. Number 2, Hitman 3. Number 3, Monster Hunter Stories 2, Wings of Ruin. Number 4, Dungeon Encounters. Number 5, Metroid Dread. Good list, right? I would argue the best list. Now for some other awards, so I can give a shout out to games that didn't crack my top 5. Best 2020 game I played for the first time in 2021. Super Bomberman R Online. This game came out for the Stadia in 2020, so it does count as a 2020 game. I had fun with Super Bomberman R, but it's a very basic, very standard Bomberman title. Online is as well, except it's online. It's framed as a battle royale game, where 64 players bomb each other until there's only one left. All the players aren't on one map, though. It starts off as several segmented Bomberman stages that get fewer and fewer as the match goes on. In between rounds, you can go between the stages, so you can purposefully pick one with a lot of players or only a few. The game works well because, well, it's Bomberman. I love the core Bomberman gameplay. Again, it doesn't do anything special or fancy here. There's no real major gameplay additions, but playing Bomberman online with an active user base is a ton of fun. It also does mimic battle royales in the sense that you are progressively getting stronger throughout the match. There are numerous characters with abilities and perks, but I like to pick the regular white Bomberman for the normal Bomberman experience. One interesting aspect is that you have 2 hearts, so you can take 1 free hit. I was a bit skeptical about this at first, since in Bomberman, typically if you get hit once, you're out. But I understand why they did it, since they want to keep players in the game for a while. You can actually refill your hearts if you find them on the battlefield. So as the battle goes on, making sure that your health is topped off is pretty important. As a game as a service title, it's a bit underwhelming. You can unlock clothes for Bomberman, but who cares? But as a game, it's classic Bomberman, and that to me is excellent. So I had so much fun playing this game, and it smartly converts the classic franchise into a battle royale without losing what makes the game exciting. It's free to play, so try it out. Best retro game of 2021 goes to Mario's Super Picross. I technically played this game for the first time in 2020, when it was added to Nintendo Switch Online. But I got really into it this year. I'm not a big Picross fan. My first Picross game was Pokemon Picross, which was fun, but had some weird free-to-play mechanics. I also tried out the Twilight Princess Picross, which was also neat, but I fell off. I can't quite understand why this one hooked me, but I think it's because it's very simple and straightforward. The puzzles aren't too challenging, but still head-scratchers at times. I also really love the music and the archaeology theme. What's funny is that I expected all the items to be Mario-related, but they aren't. The puzzles are really random things like dolphins or the Big Dipper or a floppy disk. There are a lot of Japanese-specific items too, which makes me understand why they didn't want to localize it for America. There are 2 modes, Mario where you have a time limit and lose time if you make a mistake, and Wario which doesn't have a time limit, but also doesn't tell you if you make a mistake. I prefer the Mario mode, but you know, Picross is Picross. The game also has 300 puzzles, which is pretty ridiculous for an SNES title. That's a lot of gameplay. No, I haven't beaten them all yet, but one day. If you have NSO, you can play it on Super Nintendo Online's app, so try it out, even if you are a Picross newbie. The best remake, remaster, port of 2021 goes to Super Mario 3D World plus Bowser's Fury. 3D World is excellent, and the little tweaks they added, like making the characters faster, greatly enhanced the game. 3D World is never content with just relying on its core mechanics, which are excellent, and instead throws out so many wacky and creative levels at you. I love the Ninja Castle and of course the Mario Kart stage. 3D World on its own would be worth a purchase, but they also added in Bowser's Fury, which is kind of a mix between an open world game and the linear Mario platforming segments. These little hub areas have their own theme and challenges, plus you're also attacked by a giant Bowser that makes platforming even more intense. Suddenly you're focusing not only on solely just making jumps, but also surviving massive fireballs that can destroy the landscape. You also need to think about your loadout in a sense because you can stock up power-ups. So you might want to go into a specific area with a Tanuki suit on hand, for example. You can clear Bowser's Fury in about 5 hours, but it takes longer if you want to 100% it. It's definitely a curious addition to the Mario canon. I think future games will follow the Odyssey formula, but maybe there is some room between the 3D series and something based more on Bowser's Fury. This year's A Short Hike Award goes to A Short Hike. I wanted to talk about this game, and I didn't know what category to put it in, So I'm going to give it one. It came out in 2019 on PC and 2020 on the Switch. So I'm a little behind, but I'm glad I gave this game a shot. A lot of titles invoke the name Breath of the Wild when talking about their influences, but I feel that most don't understand what made that game special. Believe it or not, I think A Short Hike captures the feeling and freedom of Breath of the Wild better than most games. You are a little bird, and your only goal is to get to the top of a mountain. On the way, you can interact with other residents of the island, find secrets, boost your stamina bar, do side quests, catch fish, or just fly around. You have complete freedom when exploring the land. Nothing obstructs you except for maybe your stamina bar. And even like Breath of the Wild, there's always another way. When you start the game, you can just turn around and find a completely optional island to explore. A Short Hike rewards players for going off the beaten path. There's no combat or real obstacles. It's a very chill experience. It certainly has an Animal Crossing vibe with all the quirky talking animals and relaxing atmosphere of the island. Talking to the other animals and hearing their stories is one of the strongest points of the game. I came across someone on the beach and then I played stickball with them. I also repeatedly bumped into another animal painting the landscape. I met another one on a boat and he told me how to fish, and then I literally caught every type of fish in the game because it was just fun to fish. The game is only 2 or 3 hours long, but they pack in so much. If you love Breath of the Wild, I cannot recommend it highly enough. Well, that's Tokyo Game Life's Game of the Year Awards. 2022 looks like a huge game is coming out every week, so it might be difficult to jump back into older games. But definitely check out everything I discussed if you have time. All right, let's check out the news. Okay, time for news. Let's look at some Japanese sales first. Pokemon Brilliant Diamond and Shining Pearl have passed 2 million retail, and Nintendo recently announced that it sold over 6 million worldwide. The game really has a lot of momentum and interest behind it. I'm curious to see if it will be helped or hurt by Legends Arceus next month. Hard to say the final number, but I can see it outselling Let's Go overall. There was a lot of backlash during the game's announcement, but I think most people are seemingly pleased with the overall experience. I mean, the core Diamond Pearl gameplay is still there, and that's a great foundation. I recently rolled credits, and I can't lie, it's definitely my favorite Pokemon RPG on the Switch. On Black Friday week, Switch sold 202,000 units in Japan, a bit under last year, which was 204,000 units. The OLED stock came in and made up for nearly half of the Switch's hardware sales. I've been seeing at department stores the big stock board, and they have OLEDs in stock here. The question is, can Nintendo keep the stock up if the OLED is going to sell tens of thousands of units each week? What didn't sell 200K is the PS5. On Black Friday week, it sold about 1,900 units. Not 190,000, 1,900. The stock situation in Japan is dire, to say the least. I know it's an issue worldwide, but Japan has been among the worst. No PS5 games are in the top 30 for Black Friday week either. This past week had the Switch dip a bit under 200K, and the top 30 games were all Switch titles. This is the third time this has happened this year, and previously it was unprecedented. The PS5 stock situation in Japan is having major effects on the software sales. Demon Slayer seemed like a slam dunk, but the PS4 version has sold about 130K retail, and is practically neck and neck with Metroid Dread. Demon Slayer, the most popular IP in Japan, can barely outsell Metroid. I certainly never thought that would happen, but the Japanese market is looking at the Switch for their video games. Fitness Boxing 2 has sold over 1 million units worldwide. This is the very definition of a sleeper hit. It's not something you see discussed in a lot of gaming communities, but it is steadily selling. The game was released in December 2020. For a lot of games, if it doesn't hit a million within a month or two, it's never going to hit it. But fitness games are kind of an untapped market, and those who want an alternative to Ring Fit don't really have a lot of options. It's kind of funny to see the contrast in the flood of games that introduced extra hardware in the Wii era to today. The Joy-Cons really are good enough for motion detecting, and I don't think many companies realize this. I haven't played it yet, but I've heard good things, and the soundtrack has Sandstorm from Darude, so I'm sure it's a masterpiece. Also in Japan, it's just called Fitboxing, which I think is a better name. A bit of sad news, Masayuki Uemura, famed hardware designer for Nintendo, passed away in early December at 78 years old. He is known for being the lead hardware designer for the Famicom, aka the NES, and the Super Famicom, also known as the Super Nintendo. It's hard to overstate his contributions to gaming. Without him, there would be no Famicom. Or perhaps there would be a significantly inferior version of it. Uemura was the guy. Yamauchi called him when they decided to jump into the home console market. His contributions to the Famicom shaped the gaming industry to what it is today. I think it's easy to forget that there are people behind these amazing inventions. And it's worth hearing their stories. There was an Iwata Asks with Uemura about 10 years ago regarding the development of the Famicom. It's still worth reading today. I tweeted it out, so please check my Twitter account. There's also a great piece in The New Yorker about him. Nintendo is expanding their office space at their headquarters in Kyoto. The company will rent 2 floors from the building next door, the newly built Kyoto Waterworks Bureau, starting in May 2022. Nintendo is also building a secondary building next to their existing one. If you look at the photos of their headquarters, that iconic bland white building, there's actually a huge empty grass patch near it, so it's likely the second building will be constructed there. This statement is in line with Furukawa's statement last month that Nintendo is dedicating $880 million to expanding their development capability. Nintendo moved into its current headquarters in 2000, and certainly a lot's changed since then. Considering their current success, expansion only makes sense. Although traditionally they are a very conservative company in many respects, you often don't see them launching new studios or purchasing existing ones. The value of Nintendo's hardware often comes from their excellent software lineup, so it's crucial that Nintendo has a steady flow of high-profile games. The Switch has been amazing in this regard, as every month has seemingly had something notable from their first-party studios. Expanding and hiring more staff will help keep up this momentum in the future. The Game Awards happened, with It Takes Two winning Game of the Year. I don't want to go on a huge spiel about the Game Awards, but I wish they would spend more time dedicated to the winners and let them speak. The last award had one guy come out and talk for about a minute. I know because of COVID, travel is a pain, but it's very deflating to see some major award being given, and one person walks up there to talk for 30 seconds in between trailers for games that are at least 2 years away. I predicted last episode that Zelda was unlikely, and hey, I was right. Not really something to brag about, though. Nintendo had virtually zero presence at the Game Awards, but there were some related announcements. Cuphead's new DLC, DLC Island, is launching next year. You can play as the newest character, Miss Chalice. They also showed the newest trailer for Sonic Frontiers, which seems to be a very Breath of the Wild-esque open-world Sonic game. You've got that classic shot of your hero looking over the cliff to a never-ending field of green, the piano, a big tower. What more do you need? I think an open-world Sonic game is an interesting concept, but one that is difficult to pull off because, well, Sonic needs a lot of room because he's so fast. I mean, if you put Sonic in Breath of the Wild's Hyrule, he's going to reach the castle in about 15 seconds. I'm thinking it will have segmented areas that are navigated via an open-world hub. It could also be similar to Mario Odyssey, where each level is a smaller open world as opposed to one seamless one. Sega has had quite a bit of time to work on this since their last title, Forces, came out in 2017. Sonic is seemingly invincible, though. No bad game can sink him. But a lot of people are amping up for a good 3D title. I mean, it's been a while. I think Nintendo not dishing out the dough to show anything proves that a bigger January Direct is on the horizon. I mean, why show something off now that could get buried when you have a big presentation in just a few weeks? As for things that might pop up in a Direct, there apparently have been some patent leaks around Breath of the Wild 2. These are regarding possible gameplay elements that could appear, and some that were even teased in the last trailer. The first is an upward warp, where players can teleport to a surface directly above them. This was shown off in the trailer, but it was ambiguous whether or not this was something the player controlled, or instead warp points from the field. But it seems like the player can teleport themselves upward to a flat surface at any time. This is kind of a strange feature, as it's hard to see what is directly above you since you will be just looking at the bottom of a platform. It also makes me wonder if you can warp down as well. Like in the trailer, another patent shows a rewind feature in regards to objects. I can see a lot of people doing creative things with this. Finally, there is a patent showing Link using his bow in the air with multiple poses, like straight down, at an angle, aiming above him, and so on. It looks like there might be some aerial combat options in this new game. I still think Nintendo is playing it a bit close to the chest in regards to the major gameplay gimmick of the game. I think it ties in heavily with the name of the game, and that's why we haven't heard anything about that yet. Hopefully they give us something more during the next Direct. Monster Rancher 1 and 2 DX was recently released on the Switch. These are remasters of the classic monster collecting RPGs from the PS1. I'm actually curious about this release. I've never played the original one, but I do love me some monsters. However, this is in the news because of a curious discovery. In the original game, you could put CDs in your PS1 and it would give you a monster. It was a very weird and cool feature that no game really ever duplicated. This feature is back in a sense. You can search through a music database instead, so no CDs are required. However, you can also seemingly search through eShop listings. User CyberwolfJV on Famiboards found that not only can you search through music CDs, PS1 games, Saturn games, and so on, but you can also search through the Switch library, including maybe the eShop. Some upcoming games like Bayonetta 3 show up, but most importantly, a game labeled Untitled Detective Pikachu sequel also appears. This game was announced all the way back in 2019, but we haven't heard anything about it since. If it is searching through the eShop listings, it's likely that an announcement for this game will be soon. Nintendo hasn't showed off anything from it, unlike Breath of the Wild 2 or Metroid Prime 4, which was also discovered. So it's certainly an interesting find. Once again, I think a January Direct is very likely, so it could be announced there, or perhaps in an upcoming Pokemon Presents either in January or February. So keep an eye out for that announcement. It could be sooner than you think. Speaking of Pokemon, Hisuian Voltorb, a regional variation of Voltorb for the upcoming Pokemon Legends Arceus, was revealed. It's electric and grass type, and its gimmick is that it's sort of a bird feeder. It's a wooden ball with seeds inside and a little hole on top. It does look much happier than the current day Voltorb. Another interesting note is that they seem to have different sizes. Kind of like Pumpkaboo, but it's far easier to see the size differences. I always liked Voltorb and Electrode. It's a modern interpretation of a Mimic, and it was implemented so well in the first game. Game Freak has tried to duplicate it with Amoongus and Galarian Stunfisk, but they were just stealing Voltorb's gimmick. They held off on showing Hisuian Electrode, but I'm going to guess his colors get flipped. There was also a trailer introducing new characters from the Diamond and Pearl clans, and also merchants from the Yinko Guild. Hard to believe that game comes out next month. I definitely expect marketing to ramp up in January. Paper Mario, one of my favorite games, was recently added to Nintendo 64's Nintendo Switch Online app. They also announced Banjo-Kazooie is coming out in January. I suppose it's easy to predict a one-game-per-month release calendar, but I think people will flip out if we go a month without one, because they will assume Nintendo has stopped. But the N64 catalog currently on the system is anywhere but comprehensive, and I suppose they want to drum up interest in NSO for the newcomers to the Switch this holiday. I love Paper Mario. It is legitimately my favorite game of all time, or at least tied with Super Mario World. If you've never played it and you have NSO, you have got to jump in. I think it hasn't aged a day. I've always wanted a remake of it because the HD Paper Mario graphics are so phenomenal, but the art style and graphics on the N64 game are still very solid. It's easily one of the best looking N64 titles. The writing is incredible, the battle system is engaging, the pacing is perfect, there's a side quest with pigs, it's got everything. I really want to go through it again, but I have a huge backlog, games are coming out that I want, and man, 2022 looks brutal on my free time and wallet. But there's always time for some Paper Mario. I'm also interested in getting back into Banjo-Kazooie. When Banjo coming to Smash was announced at E3, I was sure Microsoft was going to tell us Banjo-Kazooie was also coming to the Switch that day. I would have paid whatever they wanted at that time, but now it's definitely hard to insert into my schedule. I fear though that if I get one or two jiggies, I might not be able to stop. Speaking of Rare, I got through the first world of Donkey Kong Country 2 a few months ago, but stopped. I really need to knock that one out as well. And if you're a Sega guy, and who isn't, 5 new Genesis titles were recently added. Sword of Vermilion, Dynamite Heady, Altered Beast, Toe Jam and Earl, and Thunder Force 2. A lot of people recommend Dynamite Heady, so I might check that one out. Altered Beast is perhaps the most famous of this batch, but honestly, the game is not that good. The first level is kind of fun and weird, but after that, it goes downhill. Do you have a Japanese eShop account? There's an indie world sale happening in Japan until December 26th. A lot of high-profile indie games like Stardew Valley, Undertale, Cuphead, Sakuna, Hollow Knight, and more at a very low price. Stardew is only 888 yen. I don't think I've ever seen it that low before. I recommend Goragoa, which is an excellent puzzle slash visual novel game. It's 750 yen, but I want to say I've seen it for less. Either way, it's worth playing. I haven't bought anything yet, but I'm definitely eyeing a few games. But like I said before, finding time is a whole nother issue. And speaking of indie world, one happened. Nintendo wasn't content with riding out the rest of the year and decided to have one more big announcement video. There were quite a lot of interesting titles. Sea of Stars, from the developer of The Messenger, is an isometric pixel RPG with music from Yasunori Mitsuda, famed for his work on the Chrono series. It looks like you have two main characters that you swap between. The graphics look excellent, and I love RPGs, so this is definitely on my wish list. It hit Switch Holiday 2022, so it's about a year away. Chicory was also shadow dropped. You're a puppy that paints the world around you, but apparently it does delve into some serious things, so it's not just a silly painting game. Though there's nothing wrong with silly painting games. It hit PlayStation and PC a few months ago, and it was pretty much universally acclaimed. It's showing up on a lot of top 10 lists, so I'm excited for it. They closed out with Omori, a pastel-colored RPG with a psychological horror bent. This is from Omocat, who I assumed was just a t-shirt company, or artist, but apparently they made a game, and it's a really popular one at that. This was the announcement with the most engagement online, and sad to say, I think I vaguely heard of it, but never played it. With a Switch release, I can see a lot of people, including myself, giving it more attention. I'm a little tired of the cute game is actually very dark gimmick, but even if you go in knowing the twist or tone shift, if it's good, it should be able to stand on its own. Vivid Knight is a roguelike deck builder that's out now in Japan in January in the West. It has a very bright anime aesthetic, and it does look like something built for a phone. Oritsu Ana Poko Gakuen from Ancient Core, Yuzo Koshiro Studio, came out today as well. It's an RPG where your party members are students from an adventuring school, and it seems like there's a lot of different party members to choose from. They can even graduate, but new students of course come in as well. You move on a grid and then initiate battles with other moving enemies. The battles also seem offset by school activities, kind of like Fire Emblem Three Houses. This concept sounds great, so if the battle system is solid and there's a lot of party customization, I definitely want to try it. Sadly, there doesn't seem to be any English version announced yet, but I'll keep you updated. That's it for the news this time. Let's dive into our feature. This episode, I'm going to feature Super Potato, perhaps the most famous retro game store in all of Japan. In the West, the retro game market is pretty crazy. Loose carts go for above $100, and pretty much every single game, even bad licensed NES titles, can fetch a hefty price. Not so in Japan. There's certainly no shortage of retro game stores here, and even stores that don't specialize in old games still sell them. For example, Book Off and Hard Off are popular used goods stores that primarily carry books and CDs. But yes, you can easily stumble upon Fox Super Famicom games for under $10 there as well. If you live in Tokyo, you can likely walk to a store that just happens to be selling retro games. Give me 20 minutes or so, and I can have a boxed copy of Super Mario Bros. In my hands. But if you're trying to find something more obscure than the best-selling games of all time, you might need to hop into a shop that only sells retro games. And among those, Super Potato has risen to the top to be perhaps the most famous. One question I had when preparing this feature was, how? Why do so many Western gamers who have never been to Japan know of the store? And how have they kept their reputation for so long, despite many alternatives? I tried to dive into the history of the store, but there's actually very little information online. Also, there's a completely unrelated company called Super Potato that messes up my searches. The retro store seems to be managed by a company called Field 7, but they seem to spring up around 2015, when the store is much older. I've looked on the net and asked around, but I can't find any info on when Super Potato was actually established. It's practically a landmark in Akihabara, but maybe it was just willed into existence by millions of game otaku. Even though its origins may be a mystery, it's easy to see the appeal to both Japanese and Western gamers. For one, it has a very silly name, Super Potato. It is definitely one of those type of wase-eigo phrases that are technically words but don't really mean anything. It's easier to communicate about in English compared to other shops, and the name is incredibly invocative and memorable. The main shop is in Akihabara, so it's in a good location and has a very striking storefront. It's three floors, and the outside has these massive signs advertising all the retro games inside. Once you see the shop, you can't help but want to go inside. The main store is in Akihabara, but there is also a smaller location in Ikebukuro. Even though it started in Tokyo, it actually has more shops in the Osaka area and even a shop in Nagoya. I've been to one of the Osaka shops, but today I want to focus on the Akihabara and Ikebukuro stores. The Akihabara main shop is three floors, where each floor specializes on different games. Super Potato uses every inch, and outside of some narrow walking spaces, every single part of the store is decked out with games or game merch. The frantic, excessive use of decorations reminds me of Don Quixote, another popular Japanese shop with a strange Western name. Even the staircases are covered in posters and advertisements. My favorite being a poster of Takuya Kimura, famed SMAP star and the main character in the Judgment series, advertising the Game Boy under the marketing Game Boy Bros. He has been around so long, I doubt there are many companies that haven't used Kimutaku. As a Nintendo fan, the third floor is definitely the most interesting. One striking element is that there are CRT set up, either running the attract screens of games, or even old advertisements. When I recently visited, I saw a commercial for Pokemon Red and Green playing on one TV. It definitely feels like a time warp. Here you can find Famicom, Super Famicom, N64, Game Boy, Wii games, and so on. Although Famicom is the oldest, it easily has the most games here in terms of volume. There are multiple aisles dedicated to Famicom, while N64, for example, only has about a quarter of one. The layout is fairly easy to understand, but the walls definitely house a lot of random items that you might not easily see unless you're specifically looking for them. One little section sells Dreamcast VMUs, HDMI cables for the Saturn, and Pikachu clocks all together. It's incredible how specific these little sections can get. One area only sells the back cover to GBAs, so if you lost your battery cover for your Spice Orange GBA, you're covered. I think most Western gamers will be in awe at how many classic titles are still in their boxes, with instruction manuals. There are even labels indicating if the box, cart, or manual has scratches. In the West, you are lucky just to find a cart, much less one with a box. A lot of them are shrink-wrapped, but keep in mind that these are re-wrapped. They have definitely been opened and played once upon a time. Even the Famicom games look practically new. On one shelf, they have a dozen copies of boxed Super Mario Bros. With a dozen copies of boxed Super Mario Bros. 3 right next to it. And oh, on the shelf below it, you've got your pick of boxed Zelda games. Last time I visited, I even saw Wild Gunman in the box with the light gun. You almost don't want to buy it, as doing so would mess with the pristine condition. But that's another part of Super Potato's appeal. Not only is it a game store, it almost serves as a mini museum. Even if you don't buy anything, just walking around and exploring Japan's gaming history can be exciting. For some people, just holding a copy in their hands for a brief moment is as good as buying it. If you don't care about the box, though, there are tons of loose carts at a lower price, especially in the Famicom and N64 area. In the Game Boy section, there's practically a wall of loose Pokemon carts. There are even notes that the batteries have been changed. As you might know, the in-cart battery for Gold and Silver can affect the save function, so to buy a copy without having to mess with that is incredibly convenient. Super Potato actually has a repair service as well, so if your Super Famicom is acting up, they can repair it. Theoretically, at least. The third floor also houses the Saturn and Dreamcast games. Saturn has certainly faded from a lot of people's memories, but in Japan it outperformed the N64 for a long time, and the total sales were neck and neck. One thing that we all remember, perhaps ironically, is the Virtual Boy. Yes, you can buy boxed Virtual Boy games here, at around $20 to $30. That is fairly cheap considering the rarity, but hey, I don't think the demand is very high for those games. There's also a Virtual Boy stand set up for you to actually play it, but the Akihabara Shops one was broken when I went there last week. Honestly, this should be priority one. Get that thing working again. The fourth floor is focused more on PlayStation and more recent retro games. Did you know the 3DS is a retro console? I don't want to deal with that fact, but it may be theoretically true. This floor also sells a lot of game magazines and encyclopedias. I highly recommend the Perfect Collection series, which are these console-specific encyclopedias with amazing photographs. I would definitely do a feature on it in the future. There's also an amusing Game Boy vending machine. You put in 500 yen and get two random Game Boy titles. Something tells me that Link's Awakening or Donkey Kong 94 aren't in this thing. While most of the Nintendo stuff is on the third floor, the fourth floor does sell Game & Watches. A lot of them are quite expensive, hitting at over $100. But Ball is fairly cheap. And hey, Ball is pretty solid. Other oddities on floor 4 include the very weird Mario and Fox statues, along with a small t-shirt stand where you can buy things like a shirt with a Dreamcast logo slapped on it. It's a pretty good logo for a shirt. Floor 5 isn't a store at all, but a mini arcade. There are about 10 or so machines set up here in Blast City Cabs. It's mostly retro fighting and beat-em-ups, but they do have Bomberman World and Versus Super Mario Brothers. The highlight is the giant Game Boy display. I'm not sure what the official name is, but it's a huge Game Boy that's about 5 feet tall with a CRT in it that shows Game Boy titles. This is actually a popular find in other retro gaming shops. I often see on Twitter people posting their encounters with one. There's also a mini Showa-era snack shop here where you can buy a lot of unhealthy snacks for only 10 to 20 yen. If you want to slip back into 1990 for a while, this floor is for you. I was surprised to see how many people were just hanging out up here, eating instant ramen and watching the rest of Akihabara out of the windows. I mean, I would hang out here on a slow Sunday too. Now that's the main shop, but what about the Ikebukuro store? It's not far from the station, and while it's much smaller and only one floor, it does have some interesting elements. The main area is dark and only lit by these red lanterns. It makes you feel like you are in some sort of retro game festival in the summer. A lot of the items here are similar to the Akihabara shop in terms of games and hardware, but they do have some unique things too. The shop does seem to have a bit more Kirby merch, so that's one point in its favor. The Ikebukuro shop also has a Virtual Boy set up, but this one actually works. Sort of. When I went last week, only one eye worked. In the past, I played the Virtual Boy here and it worked perfectly, so something horrible has happened since then. Oh, and using the same VR goggles that other people have used? Not exactly sanitary. There is a scent. But right next to this display is a working Famicom box. The Famicom box is a huge, well, box that houses multiple Famicom games. Think of it like a CD changer if you are old enough to remember that. These were often installed in hotels and guests could rent games to put inside of it. The carts they use are more similar to the NES-style ones. You can also play Duck Hunt, and they even have the light gun for you to set up and play. The orange one, though, obviously for safety purposes. The Ikebukuro shop also has quite a lot of PC Engine games and old Famicom guides. So, sounds amazing, right? I can't say definitively it is the best retro shop in Japan, though, because there is a hidden dark side to this store, the pricing. For tourists, you might be amazed at a box copy of Ocarina of Time for $25. But in reality, that is incredibly overpriced compared to other shops. I bought my copy of Ocarina of Time in box for about $8 at a book off. Super Potato is certainly aware of its reputation and its popularity with foreign tourists, so it takes that opportunity to sell titles at a much higher price than normal. Even in Akihabara, I would argue places like Tsurugaya's game shop is better in terms of pricing and maybe stock depending on what you want. But I'm coming at this from the angle of living in Japan. Of course, I have the time to leisurely check and compare retro game prices or shop online. If you are visiting Tokyo, there's nothing wrong with hitting up Super Potato, getting your fill, and then going on to your next adventure. Yes, there are things to do in Japan outside of digging through old Famicom games, believe it or not. just go to any matcha or traditional Japanese sweets cafe. I promise all of them are amazing. Even if you don't plan on buying anything, visiting Super Potato is a must for retro game fans. It might not have everything, but it certainly has enough, and the fun decorations make for some great pictures and memories. In future episodes, I'll be discussing some other lesser-known retro game shops, so look forward to that. Now for the Japanese gaming word of the week. This week's word is chohanno. Chohanno. It directly translates to super reaction. This refers to something in a game being pulled off in a way that no human could possibly replicate it. Think, for example, fighting games. You know how sometimes the AI can read your inputs so it blocks at some absurdly perfect moment? That is chohanno. It is mostly used with multiplayer games where the CPU input is far faster and more precise than the human one. I was really frustrated with chohanno type reactions in ARMS because you have to actually move your body to attack. So it's very easy to see that there's no way some human could physically move as fast as the CPU. I would say ARMS still has chohanno using button controls too. Those CPU fighters can be brutal. One more time, chohanno. And the Japanese tweet of the week. This week's tweet is from Kirigami Papa at P Kirigami. This is a Japanese kirigami artist. You may have heard of origami, where you fold paper to make elaborate designs, but kirigami brings scissors into the equation. So cut and fold. He makes wonderful paper Pokemon that are incredibly detailed in their shape and design. The tweet I linked to has a lot of winged bug Pokemon, including all the Vivillon patterns. It kind of looks like one of those scientific bug displays, but far less creepy. The Twitter account is just the finished product, but Kirigami Papa also has a YouTube channel that shows him actually making it. Definitely a cool follow if you're into Pokemon or Kirigami. Now for reader mail. I have a message here from Brian asking, is it cheaper to buy Switch games on the Japanese eShop? I would say in general, no. The default price for most games is notably higher than the West. The West has a hard $60 limit. Well, $70 now, I guess. For most games in Japan, it could be anything. It's not uncommon for a game to launch at 8,500 yen here. That's about $80. Indie titles are about the same price, though sometimes they can be an arbitrary $10 more. If it is the same price, I suppose there are cases where games are technically cheaper in Japan, considering the currency exchange. The eShop sales are often not concurrent with each other. In the news section, I talked about the Indie World sale that is happening only in Japan right now, so many of those indie games are a bit cheaper than their US titles right now. I will say that Japan still uses the voucher system if you are an NSO subscriber. So for 9,900 yen, which is about $90, you can get two full-priced Nintendo-published Switch games. So you are getting one brand new Nintendo game for under $50, which is amazing. This is especially useful for those super expensive games. Metroid Dread and Astral Chain are about 8,600 yen as a standalone title. But just pay $10 more and I can get a whole other game? You can't beat that deal. I have a US credit card that I sometimes use to buy games, but if I buy a Nintendo game, I will use the voucher system. For indie games, if the price is close enough, I go ahead and buy it on the Japanese eShop. The only time I really break out my credit card is if it's a new non-Nintendo game with a big price discrepancy between the US and Japan, like Monster Hunter Stories 2. Thanks for your question, Brian. For listeners, you can write in at tokyogamelife@gmail.com and I will answer it. That's all for this week. Thanks as always for listening. Be sure to like and subscribe on your favorite podcast app. It should be on all of them by now. I also have a YouTube channel where I put up the audio version, so check it out there too. I'm also on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. Just search for Tokyo Game Life. I don't want to brag, but I post a lot of cool stuff on my social media channels. And it's a great way to get a preview of upcoming episodes. Also, I have an actual website, tokyogamelife.com, with supplemental material and transcripts. If you want to read along, feel free to do so on the website. The next episode will be next year, Sunday, January 2nd. So please look forward to that one. Like this episode, it will be kind of a special episode. All right, see you next time. Mata ne.